Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Talking France. In this week's Talking Points, we'll look at why the French are so down about the Olympics right now. Are they understandably worried that everything's going to go wrong and it's going to be a disaster, or are they just excelling in that famous Gallic sport of complaining? And we'll hear the story of France's famous Michelin guide and who the secret restaurant inspectors are. We'll examine the latest row around schools in France and learn about why the euro coins in your pocket are going to look different soon. And we'll ask the question, why in France do political leaders only become liked once they are dead or retired? I'm Ben McPartland, your host, and I'll be joined this week, as usual, by the local France team, editor Emma Pearson, journalist Jen Mansfield, and politics expert John Litchfield. Thanks for being with us again, guys. Shall we crack straight on?
Let's do it.
In just over 4 months' time, Paris will host what organisers say is the biggest event ever organised in France. And this is a country that has held some big events, including football and rugby World Cups. I'm referring, of course, to the 2024 Olympic Games, which begin in Paris on July the 26th. During the Games, organisers proudly say on their website, Paris will become the centre of the earth for, quote, an adventure that will take the whole of France on board for a unique experience. So exciting, Emma. France, and in particular Parisians, must be absolutely beside themselves with excitement, struggling to work, eat, sleep with all the hope and anticipation ahead of these games. Is that the case?
I'm not sure.
Go on.
I think the stage we're at now is the stage of complaining, fear, and some slightly mad controversies. Mm. And I do remember a lot of this type of thing happening in London in the run-up to the 2012 Games. So I don't think that is a totally Parisian phenomenon. So let's have a look at where we are. So in terms of organisation, it's going okay. The two major building projects, which are the Athletes Village and the Aquatic Centre, those are now finished. The rest of the events of the Games are all being held at pre-existing venues. Some of these, like the Stade de France and the Grand Palais, they're closed for planned refurbishment up until the Games. And others, like the open-air Place de la Concorde and the Champ de Mars, they'll be turned into venues just a few weeks out of the Games themselves. I think probably the two things that organisers seem most nervous about are both related to the River Seine. Firstly, whether the river will be clean enough to swim in for the open water swimming events, and also how to manage security for the very ambitious planned opening ceremony along the river.
Okay, you mentioned controversies, and it does feel like every time there's an announcement about the Olympics, there's a big hullabaloo, an angry backlash, lots of moans and groans. Run us through a couple of these recent ones, Emma.
Yeah, I think probably the most recent controversy is rumours that a French singer called Aya Nakamura will perform at the opening ceremony. Now, this hasn't actually been confirmed yet, but she's one of the best-selling artists in France, and apparently she is also the most listened to French language female singer on Spotify. So, I mean, it wouldn't be surprising if she was chosen. It would be kind of like getting Beyoncé to sing at the opening ceremony if the Games was in the US. Nevertheless, a small extremist group called Les Natives, the Natives, hung a banner by the River Seine that read, "There is no way, Aya, this is Paris, not the Bamako market." And Bamako being the capital of Mali, which is the country that Aya was born in before immigrating to France with her family as a child. Mm-hmm. There are also reports of boos at a rally for the extreme right politician Eric Zemmour when her name was mentioned. And I should say the anti-racism organisation SOS Racisme has filed a legal complaint against the people who hung the banner. But I think we do need to keep this in perspective. This is a really small and really extreme group of people who are basically racists. Most of France loves Aya Nakamura, judging by her ticket and her album sales. And I'm told by the young people, like Jen, that her music always gets a great reaction in the clubs. I'm not really hanging out in those myself because I'm too old, but I'm told she's extremely popular at clubs and festivals. The rumour is that she will sing an Edith Piaf song, but organisers are keen to keep a few surprises about the ceremony, so we might not find out until the evening of Friday, July 26th. And the other controversy that we had in the last week was about the Olympics poster, and I must admit I didn't actually realise that the Olympics poster was a thing, but it is. The Paris one is now out. It's a drawing of a kind of fantasy version of Paris next to the sea, encompassing some of the elements of the Games. The controversy, and I use that word loosely, comes from several right-wing politicians tweeting that the poster is too woke because it doesn't include the French flag and the building of Les Invalides is drawn without its cross on the top. But as I said, the poster depicts Paris with a coastline, so I think maybe it wasn't supposed to be, you know, 100% realistic.
Okay, we should remember in recent months there's been moans about the cost of Olympics tickets, fears about whether public transport will cope, concerns about strikes, worries about the Seine River water, as you said, Emma, anxiety about security, and even the poor little red Olympics mascot got hammered because lots of people reckon it looked like her.
You know what it is, Ben.
Clitoris.
Yes.
All this negativity has been dubbed Géo bashing or Jeux Olympiques bashing. But Emma, what about these famously positive Parisians? Surely they're full of optimism, can't wait for the games to begin.
Yeah, I don't like to peddle a stereotype, but in my experience, Parisians do love a good complain. It's like being back in Yorkshire, honestly. I think we've seen an uptick in the complaining in the last couple of weeks because what's happened is there is a special website set up intended to help people who live in Paris plan their lives through the games. And there's also a publicity campaign. You see lots of posters on the metro, on the street. It's kind of just urging people to get organised. And one of them has suggested that people might want to think about working from home during the games if they can. And I think that's just sort of reminded people that, yes, there will be disruption to everyday life during the games, especially if you live in the city centre. The website itself, I have to say, is actually pretty useful. It reminds locals like us to do things like buy your transport tickets in advance to avoid the price hikes during the games, tells people what streets will be closed off, and gives advice on things like remote working. And it'll be updated the closer we get to the event as well. On the evening of the opening ceremony itself, there will be more disruption. There'll be lots of streets closed off in the city centre. There's going to be a greatly expanded no-fly zone over Paris and the surrounding area, so that will affect flights in and out of Charles de Gaulle and Orly airports. And there might be a halt on trains in and out of certain stations as well. SNCF has put tickets on sale for the summer with the exception of July 26th. Mm. And they say they're just kind of waiting further instructions, so you can't buy train tickets for that day at the moment. This is just a one-day thing, though. So for the rest of the games, trains and planes will run as normal.
OK, we'll come back to this incredible opening ceremony shortly. I'm going to bring in John Litchfield, our politics expert here. John, when it comes to the Olympics, even some French seem to admit they have taken complaining to a new level. Are they really Europe's biggest moaners, or is that an unfair reputation on the French, John?
I don't think the reputation is entirely undeserved, Ben, no. I mean, I think the French just are a querulous, critical people. You know, it's their nature, and in some ways can be a very good thing. But they do tend to dwell on the negative rather than the positive, you know. And I think that one of the reasons, though, why the Olympics seems to be unpopular with only a few months to go is if you compare it to London a few years ago, there was a kind of, you know, gathering sort of cheerleading by the British media for it for months before. You haven't had that here. You know, the media, even though criticism they've been publishing, has not really said this is a great moment for France to be on the stage of the world. This is something we should all be proud of. You see very little of that in the French media. It will probably change, you know, when it gets nearer to the time, there will be much more flag waving. But it seems to me it's partly the sort of natural French instinct to criticise, but it's also a sort of lack of there's not saying there's not patriotism, there is patriotism, but there's unwillingness to sort of make the positive case in France for almost everything, which I find, especially in the French media, which I find different to other countries.
Thanks, John. Right, Emma, let's talk briefly about this opening ceremony. Just to recap, opening ceremonies are normally held in the main Olympic stadium, but Paris organisers have basically said, nah, that's boring. We're going to hold it on the River Seine in the heart of Paris. What's the latest on this?
Yeah, so it seems like here the creative forces and the security forces are at loggerheads over this one. Basically, the organisers, as you said, they've conceived this really ambitious, really spectacular ceremony out on the river in the open along a 6-kilometre course. Never been done like that before. And the security guys are saying, yeah, this will be a nightmare event to police. So we've already seen some changes. The original idea was to have a seated viewing area along the lower banks of the Seine with paid for tickets, and they've mostly already been sold, and then a standing area along the upper banks of the Seine, which would be ticketed but with free tickets. Now, so far, because of security concerns, we've seen the total number of spectators cut from the 600,000 that the organisers originally wanted down to 300,000, and now it seems like those free tickets will not, after all, be open to everyone, but will be assigned to organisers to distribute after the Interior Minister said that the security risk was too great from an open ticket sale. The exact details of this are still being finalised, but it seems like sporting associations will get some, Paris City Hall will get some, other local authorities will get some. So there may still be some tickets available via those routes, but I think it's quite disappointing for people who would really look forward to that event, like me, for example. I guess I'll just have to decamp to one of the fan zones, of which there will be 30 in and around the city, and kind of soak up the atmosphere that way.
Okay, now what about Parisians? Are they going to stay during the Olympics, or they're all fleeing as they usually do in summer and going to rake it in from renting their apartments out? What's happening?
Well, I mean, the better off Parisians do typically leave the city in July and August anyway, because it's some holiday season. But actually, I saw some polling this week that said 69% of residents of the greater Paris region say they plan to stay put during the Games. So I think it's probably not going to be this mass exodus that people had perhaps imagined. I imagine that will be slightly higher among the central areas of Paris, partly because those areas will see more effect from the Games. And also because, yeah, there's an opportunity to make some money by renting out your apartment on Airbnb. I know a lot of people are talking about this, but if you're planning to really do it, then you need three things. You need to either own your apartment or have written permission from the landlord to rent it. If you're in Paris itself, you need to register in advance with the mairie. And then when next year's tax declaration comes round, you will need to declare the extra income that you've made. And Airbnb sends information about rentals direct to the French tax authorities. So don't think you'll get away with failing to declare and pay tax on extra cash you've earned during the Olympics.
All right. I was thinking we could rent out this office to a family of four. In a couple of weeks. No, there's enough space for bed down.
We'd have asked the mice to leave first.
That's true. Yeah, indeed. Right. Experts say all this negativity is likely to fade away as soon as the sport gets underway, once that opening ceremony is over. Macron has set a target for France to finish in the top five of the medal table. Do you know what they where they finished in the last Olympics? Any guesses?
I don't know, 10th maybe?
Oh, well done. Spot on, Emma.
I just doubled five.
Yeah, so they're going to have to make a major improvement. We'll hope the French athletes are going to be a bit of pressure on them, but let's hope they succeed. We should plug our Olympics newsletter, guys. Emma, do you want to say a word about our Olympics newsletter?
Yeah, so we've now set up a special Olympics newsletter. It's aimed at people who are going to be in Paris or some of the other venues for the Games. It's kind of a combination of like latest Games news, but also practical information. Yeah. So like if you're coming to Paris, we'll teach you like how not to get scammed by taxi drivers, how to find a good restaurant, how to get around, how to get to the various Games events, that kind of thing. And it comes out every week.
Excellent. Just go to the newsletter options on the website and you can sign up for that Olympics newsletter. Thanks, Emma. This week saw an important event in the French cultural calendar. It was the day the famous Michelin Guide unveiled its annual list of the best French restaurants. And it was a bonanza year with a total of 62 restaurants being awarded at least one star, or étoile as they refer to them in French. Jen, tell us a bit more about this year's list of restaurants which are étoilés.
Well, a lot of restaurants that got their first star this year have only been open for less than a year, which is pretty exciting. So a lot of new restaurants. And the chef Fabien Fer became the youngest in France to ever be awarded three stars at the age of 35. He's the chef of the restaurant La Table du Castellet in southern France. The director of the guide, Gwendal Poulenec, said that the 2024 group really marks the emergence of a whole new generation that we could feel coming up. But in terms of the demographics of who's actually awarded a Michelin, there were only six women who got the star. The guide did acknowledge this. They said there are too few women at the head of kitchens, despite there being more and more numerous in culinary schools and restaurant teams. Plinik also acknowledged this. He said that it's a reality we deplore, but he's hopeful that there are more initiatives to promote talented women.
He made the point to say that French cuisine is no longer stuck in the past. But tell us a bit more about the history of this Michelin guide, Jen. It's really interesting. And it's been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, over a century. The Michelin Guide was actually started in 1900 by two brothers, André and Édouard Michelin, who worked as tire manufacturers. They initially just wanted to build a guide that would help encourage people to drive. So at the time, there were just a couple thousand cars on the road. And so their guide had maps and places you might want to stop. So tire repair shops, hotels, and restaurants. Eventually, they realized that that restaurant part was pretty popular, so they hired a team of people to act as these like secret investigators, basically going to restaurants anonymously, testing out the food and then writing up their review. And then in 1936, they established the special star system. So one star for a very good restaurant in its category, two for exceptional cooking worth a detour, and three for exceptional cuisine worth a special journey. And the guide was unsurprisingly suspended during the World Wars, but the 1939 version was used for official military purposes by the Allied forces because it was seen as one of the most up-to-date maps of France available.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, you touched on something special about the Michelin guide. It's the secrecy of the inspectors. They don't just turn up to these restaurants dressed as the Michelin man, do they? These inspectors are still a big part of the process, right? Do we know anything about them? Can you tell us any more?
Well, we don't know much about them, and that is kind of the whole point. Michelin does not say how many people it employs, but we do know that there are 25 different nationalities represented in the current cohort, and it's made up of men and women operating across all 45 of the locations that are covered by the guide around the world. If you become a Michelin inspector, you basically have to promise to live undercover like a spy. Apparently, Michelin gets over 8,000 applications a year, but in order to apply, you do have to have some qualifications. You're supposed to come from fine dining or hospitality to begin with, and you need to show that you've had at least 10 years experience as a chef, sommelier, or hotelier. And then once you're selected, you train for another 2 years to learn the Michelin method. You have to have an amazing memory because you can't just whip out a notepad and take notes at the restaurant, though apparently now you are allowed to take pictures on your phone. And you're only allowed to tell your family about your job. And a lot of times when Michelin inspectors go to restaurants, they give fake names and fake phone numbers because they don't want to leave a trace at one restaurant to another. And in order for a restaurant to get 3 stars, there has to be a complete consensus among the different inspectors that have visited.
Wow. Now, these anonymous reviewers can, of course, make or break reputations with very tangible impacts on the success of a restaurant or the chef, as was the case with French celebrity chef Marc Veyrat, who was famously stripped of a star in a high-profile row that ended up in court. He claimed that a Michelin inspector mistakenly thought he had made a souffle with cheddar cheese instead of using local ones from the Alps. The chef basically said the inspector was incompetent, but Michelin called Veyrat a narcissistic diva, suffering from pathological egotism. What a great row. But it did shed light on just how much these Michelin stars do mean to top chefs. Emma, I presume you're not an inspector, but have you ever eaten at a Michelin star restaurant in France?
No, but I have eaten at one that got awarded a Michelin star a couple of months later. So I'll take that.
All right,
it was very good. They had duck flavoured macaron. What I remember most about it. This is in the Southwest. Everything is flavoured with duck, but they were very good.
Jen, you eat at one once a week?
Oh, yeah. I get paid so much. I'm always eating at Michelin restaurants.
I have actually eaten at a 2-star Michelin restaurant.
Oh, yeah?
On a press trip in Picardy about 20 years ago. I can't remember anything about it. I remember it being slightly better than what I cook up at home.
Only slightly.
But I honestly can't remember anything about it. And white tablecloths, and you're not allowed to fill your own wine. He comes over and fills your wine. It was a bit stiff, but it was good food anyway. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Jen. France is getting new coins, 10 cents, 20 cents and 50 cent coins, and they're going to be gradually put into circulation between this spring and summer, marking the first time since France adopted the use of the euro that the country will change the national side of these smaller coins. But there's something else that is special about them. They'll have some important faces on the back, Jen.
Yes, so France picked 3 influential women to go on the national side of these coins. And all of them happen to be buried at the Pantheon. So you've got Simone Veil, the women's rights activist and Auschwitz survivor and former French politician, on the 10 cent coin. Then you've got Josephine Baker, the American-born singer, activist, and resistance fighter, who's going to go on the 20 cent coin. And then you've got Marie Curie, who was also a naturalized French person like Josephine Baker. She won the Nobel Prize twice for her research on radioactivity, and she's going to go on the 50 cent coin.
I'm just looking in my pocket, but I've got no coins in there. I didn't know that people went on them or that they changed. What are the rules around these coins, Jen?
So the gist is that each euro coin, so the 1 euro and the 2 euro, plus the 1 cent, 2 cent, 5 cent, 10 cent, 20 cent, and 50 cent coins.
Well done.
They have a common side as well as a national side. And that national side can be changed every 15 years. So in 2022, France changed the national side for its 1 euro and 2 euro coins. So now the backs of these show oak and olive branches that form a tree of life meant to symbolize strength, solidity, and peace. And the tree and the motto are placed within a hexagon, which is meant to symbolize France. Now, France is changing the 10-cent, 20-cent, and 50-cent coins, and up until 2024, they all showed the same thing. So they showed the semeuse, which is the sower, or a classical figure that appeared on the silver coins of the Third Republic. Basically, it's a woman wearing a dress, the Phrygian cap, that's the one that's the Olympics reference, and an apron, and she's walking barefoot, and she's sowing the field in one hand and then carrying a large sack in the other. And other countries, they have different designs for their national side. So Belgium's 1 euro coin shows King Albert II. Germany's 1 euro coin has the traditional symbol of German sovereignty, the eagle, which is surrounded by stars that are representing Europe.
Okay. And is it the same for banknotes? Are they country specific?
No. When it comes to the banknotes, they don't show national features or individual people. So the front of each note shows windows and doorways, which are meant to symbolize European openness and cooperation, according to the European Central Bank. And on the other side, there are bridges, which are meant to symbolize communication between the people of Europe and the rest of the world. But interestingly enough, each of these has a different architectural style. So they're meant to showcase a different period of European history. So it goes from classical, Romanesque, Gothic, Renaissance, Baroque, and Rococo to the 19th century iron and glass architecture. And the idea is that you don't want to favor any individual nation. So they're not using existing monuments or bridges. So you may have thought that you saw the Pont du Gard on the 5 euro bill, but in reality, it's just meant to illustrate a bridge of classical architecture from the first century.
That's not the Pont du Gard on the 5 euro
bill? It is not, no.
Did you know any of this, Emma?
No, I did not. I thought they were all real, real places and real bridges. I have to say, I was very much enjoying Jen's sarcastic voice when she was reading out the European Central Bank's thesis on this. Maybe it's a little bit pretentious, but it's a nice idea, European openness and cooperation.
Thanks, Jen. I really did learn something there. Let's move on to the French school system. There is a new row developing. Now, if you've walked past a French school recently, you might have seen a banner saying something along the lines of Non au tri social des élèves. This has to do with Macron's government's plan to reform the education system a little, which always, always causes a rumpus. What's this latest reform, Jen?
So this controversy might be a bit surprising to people who come from a school system that does streaming or putting kids in sets, basically separating out students based on their aptitude and putting them into different courses. Streaming is pretty standard in the US and the UK, but in France, kids in state schools all learn together until high school when they're separated into either vocational or academic tracks. Basically, Gabriel Attal, the prime minister, wants to create a choc de savoir, or a clash of knowledge, to improve math and French levels. And one of the measures involved would be streaming students in early secondary school, so from the age of 11, into groups based on their ability for math and French, but not for other subjects. And it's set to start in French secondary schools in September 2024. The Ministry of Education published a note on the changes. They explained that kids are going to be able to change groups during the year in order to take into account their progression and diversity of needs. And then kids will go back and forth between these streamed classes and the overall group during the year as well.
Okay. Do we know why the government wants to push this through now, Jen?
Well, the PM had apparently been planning the initiative for a few months prior to announcing it, but the initial announcement did come right after the PISA International Education Rankings were released. And most countries did see student achievement in math, reading, and science drop due to the pandemic, but France recorded a pretty astounding decrease. So France's PISA math scores went down by 21 percentage points between 2018 and 2022, and its reading comprehension score dropped by 19 points. Between 2012 and 2022, the drop in math achievement was widespread across France. And as of 2022, almost a third, so 29% of pupils, were struggling with math, and only 7% were judged to be doing very well.
So understandably, there is some pressure for France to improve its scores. But I presume, Jen, teachers' unions, are they unhappy about the prospect of streaming? And why is that?
Yeah, so there's a giant poster outside of my apartment that says No au groupe de niveau, no to level groups. And there are similar signs outside of many schools. The gist is that teachers and teaching unions see any type of academic tracking as contrary to the principle of the Republic, equality. The theory being that mixed ability in classes helps the more able kids bring along the weaker ones. So solidarity within the classroom. Sophie Venetite from the SNES FSU Union, which which is one of the main unions representing secondary school teachers, she told French media that in spirit, level groups go against the idea that pupils succeed by working together and being confronted with diversity. And then the chairman for the Parents Association, FCPE, told West France that sorting devalues self-confidence of pupils. He said the best will continue to progress and the least good will continue to drop out. In reality, it's the overcrowded classes that are holding back academic success. I've taught in the French public school system, and I do have to say that I did not find it to be one that produces a lot of confidence to begin with. Teachers had no issue doing unofficial sorting in the classroom, you know, splitting the kids that did well on the test into one group and the kids that needed extra help into another. And there weren't a lot of kind words for the kids that failed. So I'm not sure about that confidence point, but that concept of equality is a big reason why there's pushback against this reform.
Okay, so they don't have setting or streaming in French secondary school, public secondary schools, but does that mean the system is equal gender? Kids end up getting sorted, or pupils end up getting sorted in some way after college?
Yeah, so that's the thing. I mean, kids are split up into vocational high schools and academic high schools at age 15, and kids from lower socioeconomic backgrounds are a lot more likely to end up in the vocational tracks. Plus, the PISA tests found that there already is a huge difference in performance, especially in mathematics, between socioeconomically advantaged and disadvantaged pupils. The well-off kids scored 113 points higher, which is well above the OECD average of 94 points higher than the other kids based on socioeconomic status. So there's even less equality in France than the OECD average, basically. And then there are also some gender-related inequalities too. So the study found that boys continued to perform better than girls in mathematics, while girls did better in reading comprehension.
Now, we've had some interesting thoughts from readers on this issue, Jen, after we put a survey out to find out what they thought. Sum up a few of them for us.
So they were kind of split. One parent, Louise, told us that she supports introducing streaming into French schools. She said, "We were asked if our daughter would like to skip a year, and we said no, as we did not like the idea of sending a 10-year-old into college. She finds school easy, so she would benefit from being in a set." Another parent, Helen, said that streaming would help her kid. She said, "My 12-year-old son has a learning disability and attends school specially adapted for motor disabled children. My son is capable of learning, but not as quickly as the others. So I fully support this type of scheme, the aim being to prepare him as well as possible for the Brevet exam in 4 years' time." That's the test that kids take at the end of college before lycée. But another parent of a kid with learning challenges, Seb, told us that he wouldn't support it because it doesn't particularly help the best attainers and harms the others. He said, "My daughter was bullied because of her learning difficulties. This would have made it worse."
Okay, let's bring back John Litchfield here. John, why has France been against streaming school pupils? And can you see anything changing here?
I'm not sure France is against it. You know, I think pupils may be against it. I don't know. But parents, I think, tend to be in favour. And opinion polls generally of popular opinion seem to be in favour. The people who are most against it are the teachers. And you have to remember that the state education system is run by and for teachers. I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. But it is, you know, over the years, the education ministries, successive education ministers have tried to change that. But essentially, the teaching unions have a lot of power in the way the teaching system works. And for whatever reasons, good or bad, French teaching unions and French teachers don't like the idea of streaming. Some people say it makes more work for them. Others say, no, it's because they have this deep belief in the kind of republican nature, the equal nature of the French system, and therefore all pupils should be treated equally and all treated as having equal chances. And if you stream them, then you're sort of declaring some of them to be ineffective from the beginning. But it's mostly the teachers that are dragging their feet rather than parents or the population at large.
And we got a fairly straightforward question to finish us off, which Emma and John are going to help us answer. It is, why do French people only love their leaders when they are either dead or retired? Emma, answer this and explain what I'm talking about, why I'm posing this question.
Well, this question was prompted by a poll that has been making headlines this week about the politicians that the French think most fondly of. It's not a voting intention, it's just good impressions of politicians. And it's actually a regular monthly poll by the IFOP polling organisation for Paris Match, the magazine. But it's hit the headlines now because of who is now the second most popular politician in France, and that is François Hollande.
No.
Yep, you remember him, of course, president from 2012 to 2017, and probably the one thing you remember about him is he was probably the most unpopular president of modern times. At one point in office, his approval rating sank to 4%, and he didn't even bother running for a second term because he could see that he was just going to get humiliated. But now he's the second most popular politician in France, and he's got an approval rating of 49%, even though he really actually hasn't done that much since he left office. Like, he appears on lots of TV programmes and debates. He's written a couple of books. He's learned English, apparently. Oh, and he got married to Julie Gayet. You remember the actress he was caught having an affair with as president. But, you know, nothing particularly weighty there. And the thing is, he's not the only one who's, you know, doing well on this same poll. Nicolas Sarkozy, president from 2007 to 2012. He's now the 10th most popular politician in France, even though, again, he was pretty unpopular when he was in office. He was derided as the president bling bling for being flashy and uncool. He was turfed out of office after a single term as well. And since leaving office, he's also written a couple of books, and he's also been convicted of bribing a judge, which you would not think would improve his reputation, but apparently it has. Ségolène Royal, she didn't even get to be president. She was the defeated Socialist Party candidate in the 2007 election, and she came fourth in this popularity poll.
This really doesn't make sense. We'll get John to shed some light on this, but Emma, just last question. Dare I ask where Macron is in this poll?
He is at number 25 with a 35% approval rating, which is actually not bad for a sitting French president. They often go way lower than that. As I said, Hollande once got down to 4%. Sarko slipped to single figures a few times as well. But I guess if this follows this trend, people will start to love Emmanuel Macron by about 2035.
Well, let's ask John this question. John, we're discussing this tendency for the French to detest current leaders and adore those who've left power. You've written in your column this week, John, what makes France unusual is its exaggerated hatred of its current political leaders and its adoration of its dead or retired ones. Is it difficult to explain this phenomenon, John?
I find it difficult to explain. I don't see that pattern in any other country to that extent. You get a certain amount of people who were disliked when they're in office being rehabilitated or having a sort of glow of kind of nostalgic opinion surrounding them, but not to the extent you have in France. I mean, just as one example, a perfect example is François Hollande, who was president before Macron until 2012. And he fell at one point to 4% approval, which is, you know, probably the lowest for any democratic country in the world, never mind any French president. He's now up to 49% approval. He's risen up to the second most popular politician in France, to the point where he's apparently even considering another run, which I think would be disastrous if he tried it. How do you explain that? I don't know. It's one of those great mysteries of French life.
John, just going, you mentioned François Hollande. He's the one who intrigues me. You know, it was almost comical how unpopular he was at one point during his presidency. Has he actually done anything to merit this rise in popularity?
Well, did he merit the unpopularity? You should ask perhaps first of all as well. I don't think he did, really. I mean, he ran a campaign which was very much to the left and then governed to the right. So he annoyed a lot of people on the left. He was never liked on the right, so he didn't leave himself as much of a constituency. But some of the things that he did in office and have been continued by Macron in terms of loosening unemployment regulations and so on are responsible for the boom in French employment and the reduction in French unemployment in the last few years. How has he come back up? I think because he's quite a genial and quite a sort of fluent speaker on comment programs. He's often there. He's become a presence. But, you know, I think it's partly just that there is a sense that the French like the sort of nostalgic glow of old leaders knocking around. I don't think there's a sort of almost a kind of compensation that goes on, that they feel that they've been unfair to people when they're in office. And so they start thinking, oh, well, he wasn't so bad after all, was he? The old Hollande, and they don't feel threatened by him anymore because he's not running anything.
Well, John, I need to ask you about Macron. You've written in your column for The Local this week, no doubt even Emmanuel Macron will be loved in 2040. Do you really believe that, John?
I don't think, will I be around to know whether I'm right or not right? I think, yes, I think so. I think that Macron will be a very good example of it. In retrospect, he will be seen to have been one of the better French presidents of the Fifth Republic, and he will be given credit for that in the years ahead. But it depends on who follows him, of course.
On that question of who might follow Macron, John, in this popularity ranking, Edouard Philippe, the former French PM, is well above Marine Le Pen, who is touted to be, you know, the next French president. Is that the case? Has Philippe got a much better chance than Le Pen because he's more popular?
It's interesting because this is a kind of league table of the popularity of French politicians that Paris Match and I think IFOP, one of the polling companies, does every month. So it's interesting to watch it. And it's slightly different from a normal opinion poll. It's not asking who would you vote for if the election was now or anything like that. If that is that question was asked, then Marine Le Pen comes somewhat above Edouard Philippe in the first round for 2027. She comes something like 20th, I think, in popularity of all French politicians, below even her number two, Jordan Bardella. And Philippe, as you say, who was prime minister in the early years of Macron's first term, has been at the top there or near the top for months and months and months. The popularity of Philippe is interesting and an interesting corrective to a kind of drumbeat that's out there in the foreign, but also in the French press, suggesting that somehow there's a growing inevitability of a Marine Le Pen presidency. I don't think it's inevitable by any means.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Emma. And thanks, Jen. Thanks to you all for listening. That brings us to the end of this week's episode of Talking France. We'll be back with more talking points next week.